Welcome to the Newsbusters podcast with the executive editor of Newsbusters, your host, Tim Graham.
Hello and welcome to this, the latest Newsbusters podcast on this appropriately somber 9/11 weekend. I'll have some thoughts at the end about how the media treated 9/11 and how 9/11 happened to me. But first, we have the story of the Biden mandates. Somebody is trying to change the subject from Afghanistan and 9/11. So the president came forward and announced, oh, we're going to make sure that anybody who works for the federal government or its contractors has to have the COVID vaccine. And we're going to task the Department of Labor through the Occupational Safety and Health Administration of making sure all companies with 100 employees or more have to have a vaccine mandate.
I'm announcing that the Department of Labor is developing an emergency rule to require all employers with 100 or more employees that together employ over 80 million workers to ensure their workforces are fully vaccinated.
This sounds like something that is not going to clear a courtroom, but maybe that's not exactly the point. This is the kind of decision that's going to have real impact on people's jobs. I have two personal friends who are willing to go seek another job over mandates like this.
This is not about freedom or personal choice.
I've been vaccinated. I think vaccination's a good thing. I think that's the answer to getting out of this mess. Clearly, what the networks aren't doing on this is saying, why is this still going on? Because we thought Biden promised this was going to be all over.
If you're vaccinated, you're not going to be hospitalized, you're not going to be in an ICU unit, and you're not going to die. You're okay. You're not going to get COVID if you have these vaccinations.
Not only that, Biden promised as president-elect that he wasn't going to impose a mandate.
No, I don't think it should be mandatory. I wouldn't demand to be mandatory, but I would do everything in my power. Just like I don't think masks have to be made mandatory nationwide. I'll do everything in my power as president of the United States to encourage people to do the right thing, and when they do it, demonstrate that it matters.
Even this summer, Jen Psaki was saying, well, we're not going to do a mandate. CBS's Nancy Korda seemed to want one, but at that time, they were saying no.
Perhaps the federal government should step in and issue mandates, and if not, are you putting the needs of unvaccinated people ahead of the needs of vaccinated people?
Well, I think the question here, one, that's not the role of the federal government. That is the role that institutions, private sector entities, and others may take. That certainly is appropriate. Also, local communities are going to take steps they need to take in order to protect people in their communities.
This, to me, seems like a Democrat president trying to please the Democrat base. You know, we understand they love to cast the conservatives and Republicans as cavalier people who don't care about, you know, mass death. And they don't really see themselves as shutdown extremists, as people who panic that you have to have two vaccines and a booster and triple masks, and it's never too much.
This is not a political issue. It's become one.
You know, the joke for me is, you know, the media always uses these terms. When you say, well, I'm going to pass a voting integrity bill that requires voter ID, what's the word that the media uses? This is the most restrictive bill on voting. We have the Texas abortion law that would protect unborn life after 6 weeks. This is the most restrictive abortion law in America. And here's Biden announcing something that's massively restrictive, that's going to lead to people headed for the unemployment line.
This is not about freedom or personal choice.
I mean, I suppose the next thing we should wait for is the Biden administration saying, I've directed the Department of Labor to saying that people who are unemployed because they wouldn't accept the vaccine are ineligible for unemployment benefits. But all of this can be seen as a massive distraction. The news media doesn't do that. The news media just picks it up and cheers it. Nick Night Train Fondacaro did the roundup here about how the networks all treated this as a wonderful night for Biden. Over on ABC, anchor David Muir sympathized with getting those annoying mandate opponents out of the way.
The president taking aim at local officials that he said are actively working to undermine the fight against COVID by opposing masks and vaccination mandates. He said, I'll get them out of the way. The president clearly frustrated with politics, the fights, the images like the ones we saw just today out of Tennessee, that young man trying to make the case. The president saying this is getting in the way of halting this virus.
Yeah, Rachel Scott ended this by saying, the president believes the steps he announced tonight will save lives, David. I mean, that's publicity. You know, that's stenographers to power. They claim to dislike this when the Republicans are in office. Well, it's our job to be adversarial. Well, why isn't it ever your job to be adversarial when the Democrats are in power? Over at CBS, anchorwoman Nora O'Donnell touted Joe Biden was taking off the gloves.
President Biden is taking off the gloves to get more Americans to roll up their sleeves. He's issuing an aggressive executive order mandating COVID vaccines for millions of federal employees and contractors.
CBS added, Biden had a clear message, get vaccinated or pay the consequences. See, they actually like that threat. Go ahead and get fired because Biden's got a clear message. Then there's NBC's Lester Holt, who touted how Biden was trading out the velvet glove for a hammer.
Good evening, everyone. Clearly frustrated by the pace of COVID-19 vaccinations in this country, President Biden tonight is trading out the velvet glove for a hammer, unveiling a broad and largely new COVID strategy heavily grounded in vaccine mandates meant to compel millions of American workers to be vaccinated.
Great, great, Lester Holt, you know. Do, 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 do. Hammer time. You know, I mean, it reminds me of my own house where my daughter put up a sign for me. She hung a sanitizer from the door and it says, stop, sanitize. So I can't see that and not think of MC Hammer. Anyway, many of us have tried. We got the vaccines, we've worn the masks, we've tried to take all the precautions, we've done the 6 feet distancing, and we were told that being double vaccinated was going to allow the world to reopen. So you have a lot of Americans right now who are unhappy with this. You know, they're collecting in stadiums, in the open air, in large quantities, and this, again, has the panickers among liberals just absolutely upset that people would assemble in large numbers. Warmed my heart as a Wisconsin native to see Camp Randall in Madison stuffed with fans jumping around like idiots to jump around in between the third and fourth quarters. It's fantastic. Now, we should mention this. The Fox News had a scoop this week. Joe Schaffstall, who used to work here at MRC TV way back when, Joe Schaffstall reports the teachers' unions, the National Education Association and the American Federation of Teachers, pressured the Centers for Disease and Control and Prevention on mask mandates. Team Biden had implied in May that masks weren't essential in schools and the teachers' unions were not happy. So suddenly, the science changed after some angry phone calls from teacher union presidents. The other networks weren't interested in this reporting because, gee, it makes COVID look political.
This is not a political issue. It's become one.
And it makes Biden look like he has to jump when the teachers' unions say jump. These people all settled instead on the anecdote of 13 school employees dying in the Miami-Dade school district in Florida. That neatly matches the teacher union messaging. There are other issues. There is Ducey time, as Curtis Houck notices. Ducey brought up several things that always makes Jen Psaki's life uncomfortable. He asked her,
explain a little bit more about why the White House in a statement is calling the Taliban businesslike and professional.
Isn't that fascinating that they'll use positive terms for a pile of terrorists? They're businesslike and professional. Oh, how 9/11 anniversary of you people. The Taliban, which provided shelter and comfort for Osama bin Laden. Well, they're businesslike and professional. And the funniest part is these are not the kind of terms that they would use for Republican governors. Joe Biden's telling them to get the heck out of the way. So the Taliban is somehow more businesslike and professional than, I don't know, Ron DeSantis, Greg Abbott. Unbelievable. Psaki replied that this notion of businesslike and professional Taliban was meant to commemorate the first flight out of some of these detained Americans.
We wanted to note that the Taliban was cooperative in facilitating the departure of these American citizens and legal permanent residents from HKIA. We promised we would get American citizens out. We promised we would get legal permanent residents out. We promised we would get our Afghan partners out. And we promised we'd press the Taliban to get them out. And that's exactly what we did.
Thankfully, Ducey was unmoved. He reminded her, the new Afghan Interior Minister, Sirajuddin Haqqani, is still on the FBI's most wanted list.
Taliban is businesslike and professional. Their interior minister has an FBI wanted poster. He's got a $10 million bounty on his head. That's what's the business?
I can only hope I would come up with a question like that if I was still in the White House press corps. Peter Ducey also pressed Psaki on Anthony Fauci's role in funding so-called gain-of-function research in the Wuhan lab.
Thank you, Jen. First on COVID origins, you've said from that podium that under no circumstance would President Biden ever fire Dr. Fauci. Is that still the case since Fauci told Congress the NIH never funded gain-of-function research for coronaviruses in Wuhan, but documents published by The Intercept suggest that is not true, which would mean that he misled Congress?
Ducey was implying that maybe Fauci should be fired. Well, that was never going to be considered. When Trump was asked about it, it was always an ongoing outrage. But you can tell here that nobody seems to hold Fauci as accountable as anybody else in the government. This whole question of the origins of the coronavirus is one of those things that the news media want to keep out of your common set of facts. The problem we have with the conservative media is they don't allow us to have a common set of facts. And these are kind of facts we don't want to talk about. It doesn't even matter if this is coming from The Intercept, which is a website run by a bunch of radical leftists. Doesn't matter. Still on the wrong side of history, apparently. Nick Nitrain Fonacare also noted, three networks skipped President Biden pulling the nomination of David Chipman from the ATF, or what do they call it now? The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. Rich Noyes added something that I absolutely loved. He tweeted, back on August 20th, all three evening newscasts covered Mike Richards stepping down as the new host of Jeopardy. So apparently, who hosts Jeopardy is a bigger deal than any time the Biden administration has to pull down a nomination. I mean, this Chipman thing got less than Neera Tanden when they had to pull down Neera Tanden being nominated for the Office of Management and Budget. She had too many mean tweets to survive. These are the kinds of stories they really don't like to do because it makes the Biden people look like, well, they failed to vet people properly. Then there's the egg-throwing gorilla. Our Christine Marsh, who went to college in Sacramento, offered the latest from the California recall. This was all over Twitter. A black conservative gubernatorial candidate, Larry Elder, had an egg thrown at him by a white lady in a gorilla mask. NBC skipped it entirely, but how ABC and CBS covered it, it was interesting. It helped them label him as controversial, spurned by so-called homeless activists.
Despite a double-digit lead over other challengers, Elder does not have widespread support. During a campaign event overnight, several homeless people chasing him away, someone throwing an egg in his direction.
Yeah, Larry Elder said, if I were a Democrat, it would be a hate crime.
Well, you know, she might be one of the 20,000 people that were released early from our prisons, felons, many of whom are violent offenders under this governor. I don't know. We have two soft on crime DAs. I consider this to be one of the many intersections in California, the intersection between lawlessness and homelessness. It was a very angry, ugly scene. You know, if I were a Democrat, obviously, this would be called systemic racism. They'd be calling it a hate crime. I don't like to play that game. I do know this. There was a big article about me, a negative, in the New York Times. It never once mentioned that I'm black, never once mentioned that I would be the first black governor of California. I never made a big deal out about that. I don't want people to vote for me or against me because I'm black. But on the very same page of the New York Times, there was a big article about the, quote, first female governor of New York, close quote. Even though she didn't get elected, she was basically appointed because the other governor resigned. So they cared about the first when it was a female Democrat, but couldn't give a rip about the first when it was a black Republican.
There's no doubt about that. This reminds me, actually, of back in 2010, in Tea Party days, when there was anger at Congress, and some Tea Party members were apparently right in the faces of some congressmen, including Emmanuel Cleaver of Kansas City. He had been mayor of Kansas City, and then he went to Congress. Back then, on March 20, 2010... David Muir reports, late word from Washington tonight about just how ugly the crowds gathered outside the Longworth office building have become. Yes, the Tea Party is ugly, he continued. We learned that as Congressman Emmanuel Cleaver of Missouri was leaving his office, someone in the crowd spit on him. There are also reports of racial and homophobic slurs, one targeting Congressman John Lewis, the famous civil rights champion. You notice all these fancy words they always use for liberals? They're always champions of civil rights. Well, the whole problem with this, if you don't remember 2010, was Cleaver wasn't really spit on. I mean, Cleaver was faced by a guy who was talking loudly and maybe got a little saliva in the yelling, but he wasn't spit on. You know, it wasn't like, "Ptoo!" in your face. And then also there was this allegation that someone had yelled the N-word at John Lewis. This was never proven. In fact, Andrew Breitbart at the time pledged $100,000 to the United Negro College Fund if anyone could provide proof that somebody yelled the N-word at John Lewis. And no one had the goods. And we could joke about, you know, how you try to doctor video to try to get the 100K. But this is one of those stories where they were so eager to believe the story of a black politician being verbally assaulted. They jumped all over it when it was a Democrat, but when it's Larry Elder, not so much. Flipping the bird. Speaking of liberal heroes of civil disobedience, CNN New Day anchor John Berman just giggled as he brought on 14-year-old liberal hero Fiona Downey and her mother Megan from Shelburne, Vermont. Oh, joy, from Bernie Sanders territory, just south of his old town of Burlington, where he used to be mayor, in the People's Republic of Vermont. So apparently there was there were some moms standing outside the school bus holding signs against mask mandates. And there was a photo taken of young 14-year-old Fiona giving them the finger. Berman says, I'm just smiling because it's one of those challenging parenting moments when you know you're supposed to say something that's not something you're supposed to do, but sort of you're whispering to yourself, right on. Liberals loved this bird flipping on social media. Actor and former pro wrestler Dave Bautista, Guardians of the Galaxy, was even offering to help fund Fiona's college tuition. Hey, do you know how much college can cost in Vermont there, pal? But, you know, this is really a tiny non-event. Why you would make a national news story out of somebody flipping a bird out a school bus window, nobody can imagine. It's sort of the same thing we had a few years ago when Trump was president. And there was a woman on a bicycle. The motorcade was going around her. She flipped the bird at the presidential motorcade. Oh, this made her a hero. I think she even ran for office unsuccessfully. But she was a hero. The Washington Post thought this was just terrific. Christine Marsh noticed CNN didn't report on legions of college students at four stadiums last weekend shouting F Joe Biden over the mask mandates. These people even wanted outdoors. Go to Oregon where they have, oh, you're outdoors in a park somewhere all by yourself with your dog? No, you should be wearing a mask. I mean, it's just, there's never an extreme with these people. But, you know, obviously if you're yelling F Joe Biden, John Berman won't giggle at you. This actually reminds me of 2019 when the teenager, the activist, was a guy named Nicholas Sandman. You'll remember this. The March for Life, 2019. Standing around on the mall in Washington wearing a Making America Great Again hat, saying nothing. And he's caught on camera smirking at some Indian activist who's pounding a drum in his face. And he became the opposite of a liberal hero. He was vilified on CNN. S.E. Cupp spent almost 7 minutes on the weekend then on her unfiltered show, lashing out at the mob of MAGA hat-wearing high school students who are clearly not getting a good education. Yeah, remember S.E. Cupp, the so-called conservative? You come up to a pro-life protest with your friends. You know, you're a teenage kid. You buy a MAGA hat just because it's fun, and you're in Washington, D.C. And S.E. Cupp comes up and says, obviously your parents are failures. This is not all that happened on CNN. There was plenty of that where it came from. Chris Cuomo said that Sandman and the other kids were victims of their own choices. Just see the dramatic contrast between Fiona the bird flipper and Nick Sandman, whose offense was smirking. You know, the only good news there was that Sandman sued CNN and got a settlement. That doesn't happen too often. But in both of these cases, whether it's the smirking or the bird flipping, is that really news? Finally, looking back at September 11, we've got a package here at Newsbusters of, at the time we did an issue of Notable Quotables, our newsletter, still on paper back in 2001, doing the good, the bad, and the ugly. And you know, there was a bunch of people who had patriotic things to say. You know, Geraldo Rivera on CNBC, we are pissed off as a nation. Well, yeah, that's true. Dan Rather almost cried on the Letterman show, asking the president, you know, send me where I need to do. But, you know, so there were some patriotic moments, but there was also a lot of nastiness, even in the immediate aftermath. Bill Maher on ABC's Politically Incorrect, and this actually was sort of the end, the beginning of the end of Bill Maher on ABC.
We have been the cowards lobbing cruise missiles from 2,000 miles away. Absolutely. That's cowardly.
That is a
staying
terrible.
In the airplane, yes, when it hits the building.
That is
say
a
what
terrible,
you want about it, not cowardly.
What kind of idiocy is that? That still sounds to me like the most brain-dead thing you can say when you want to somehow compliment the terrorists driving a jet plane into a building full of innocent Americans. He was not the only one. Novelist and playwright Susan Sontag, which one of them did this first? The September 24 issue of The New Yorker magazine, center of Manhattan snobbishness. She said, if the word cowardly is to be used, it might be more aptly applied to those who kill from beyond the range of retaliation, high in the sky, than to those willing to die themselves in order to kill others. In the matter of courage, a morally neutral virtue, whatever may be said of the perpetrators of Tuesday's slaughter, they were not cowards. Yuck. The late Susan Sontag. She should feel lucky she wasn't in the World Trade Center that day. Then there was this guy, Boston Globe columnist Derek Z. Jackson, a native of Milwaukee. Whoever attacked the World Trade Center and the Pentagon and our sense of daily trust and freedom must be found. But America must find itself, too. The targets clearly represented America's global power, a power that is not innocent of arrogance, either militarily or economically, with all the condolence that can be offered. It is incongruent to think that the world's leading exporter of the tools of death and destruction would not someday be visited with an evil in return. So basically, Derek Z. Jackson is giving us the Reverend Jeremiah Wright message. The chickens have come home to roost. You know, how you can cheer on 9/11. And he wasn't done. A week later, this was Derek Jackson's column on September 12, I just read you. A week later, Derek Jackson again, when stock traders sing God Bless America, and the New York Stock Exchange CEO says America's ready to go back to business, it's unclear how much of America's business is worthy of God's blessing. So much of it is so obviously decadent. A nation of SUVs backing out of huge energy-sucking suburban houses to purchase insane stores of food at Sam's Club, with a stop at Starbucks along the way. There is no regard to how it came to be that the rich can get goods and grain so cheaply, while the poorest 20% of the world can access only 5% of the world's meat and fish. Yike. You know, this is the whole thing, is liberals are never going to think that we're a bunch of fat and happy rich bastards. We're never really going to deserve what we have in America, because the third world's always going to make us look like a pile of entitled idiots. That's what he's going to write in the aftermath of 9/11. So who's subscribing to the Boston Globe? Obviously, a bunch of leftist Harvard eggheads. I wouldn't subscribe. I do get their email newsletter, so I can make fun of them. Finally, I want to remind people of what happened in the immediate aftermath. I heard this in person in the White House press room. If you'll remember, what happened on 9/11 was President George W. Bush got onto an airplane and was flying out of Washington. The notion was that the White House might be targeted by the terrorists. That's obviously the fact that they flew a plane into the Pentagon would suggest that that was a target. But the liberal reporters were basically trying to suggest Bush was a coward. On CBS's The Early Show, September 13, Bryant Gumbel, Bill Plant, still no hard evidence that in fact the White House or Air Force One were targeted. Are you somewhat surprised by the hypersensitivity of this White House? And Bill Plant said no, but then Gumbel comes back. Well, but again, no hard evidence that we've seen yet that they were targeted. Then there's Mary McGrory of the Washington Post, the yellow doggiest of the Democrats, on Nixon's enemies list and proud of it. She was still hammering the Republicans under George W. Bush. September 13, 2001. George W. Bush could not find the beat. He jarringly referred to the terrorists as folks in his first public comments, during which he looked more apprehensive than resolute. He allowed himself to be hauled about the country like a fugitive to bunkers at air bases in Louisiana and Nebraska. The capital of the free world was a ghost town in a desperate hour. Bush said the attack was a test for the country. It was also one for him. He flunked. That's it. That's 2 days after 9/11. You know, most of the media Democrat complex tried to be unified and patriotic for a few weeks, you know, maybe for the rest of September, you know, maybe for a month, and then things got back to normal. I mean, obviously, to some extent, when Bush actually launched the war in Afghanistan, that changed the tenor. I can look ahead to other issues and notable quotables in the fall of 01, and then what happens is the network starts saying, our Taliban guides took us around to show us the path of American destruction of civilian life. You know why they did that, because the Taliban is businesslike and professional. Some things never change. Finally, just a moment on what 9/11 was for me. I know that Curtis Houck and Nick Fondacaro discussed their memories of their childhood reaction. I was a White House correspondent, newly minted, at World Magazine, And I remember, I think it was close to 9 o'clock when the first jet went in, or maybe when the second jet went in. But obviously the first one was sort of considered some sort of horrible accident. The second one showed us it was not an accident. So I was supposed to go to the Capitol, and I was driving around the Beltway, and DC 101, the rock station, was running a simulcast of ABC News. So you had this weirdness of ABC News being played on a rock music station. That's the way it was that day, as everybody was tuned to the news. And we didn't really know what was going to happen next at that point. And then, so I was driving around the Beltway. I'm on the southern end, headed toward Alexandria, where the MRC offices were at the time. And I saw this huge plume of smoke off in the distance. And I just had a feeling that that was the Pentagon, just from the location of the smoke. And so I decided I better go and see if I could get in there, since I was a reporter now. Had to go and see what I could possibly observe. And I remember I drove right past the old MRC coming up Highway 1 and came into Crystal City. And there, in the back of all of the hotels there next to Reagan National Airport, it was all a black cloud. You could see these white, like the white Marriott Hotel, and the black cloud was all around it. And I had one reaction. I just about crushed my steering wheel into powder. I was just so angry that they had attacked our Pentagon like this. Certainly wasn't feeling like an objective reporter at that time. I was able to drive in there. My wife was on the phone with me. I had a very primitive cellular phone, not quite as big as the ones on Saved by the Bell, but it was a clunky phone. And she's like, don't go in there. And I'm like, I'm a reporter now. This is what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to go to the scene of things and see what happened. And somehow in the chaos, I didn't see the plane. I only saw the smoke. Somehow I was able to drive in there. There were like emergency vehicles coming out. I was able to drive in there and park. And I did some interviews with people who were standing outside, and they were explaining to me this was a part of the Pentagon that had just been newly reinforced and so on. And I did some interviews, and then I was like, I went back to my car, and they're like, you can't drive your car. You know, it was part of the security perimeter or whatever. So I'm like, oh, okay. So I decided I need to file my story. This was a Tuesday, and our weekly deadline was on Tuesday. So I was like, all right. I decided to hike back down to the MRC offices at that time in Old Town Alexandria. That's about a 5.5 or 6 mile walk. And what was funny is there were a lot of people walking south at that time. It was more like a parade of people going down the sidewalk. And it was so chaotic that those of us who were walking were moving faster than the automobiles. And I did make it down to the old offices, and they allowed me to come in, type out a quick story about what I had seen that day. Emailed it in from the MRC to my bosses at World Magazine. And then I was able to, since I didn't have a car, I got on the metro and metroed out to Vienna, took a bus to Centerville, where we lived at the time, and my wife picked me up, and she was just happy I was safe. And that was a pretty memorable day. And, you know, people were wondering where I was. Obviously, if I'd been at the White House that day, who knows, you know, if the White House had been targeted. I worked there. I didn't work there all the time. I didn't have an office there, but I did go there to the briefings and whatnot. I suppose that's possible. You know, I just come away with the notion that my day then was more memorable because I was a White House reporter than it might have been if I was just an old media watchdog like now. And it's one reason I realize that reporters often go to dangerous scenes that I don't have to go to. I just watch TV, you know, like the 6 screens of live TV that we have in our lobby here at the MRC when you get off the elevator. You know, everyone who just needs courage just to go to work, just to do their job, deserves our respect, especially those who keep the rest of us safe and secure. So stay grateful for the people that keep us safe, and stay grateful for what America is and hopefully will remain to be. And come check us out at Newsbusters once, twice, 24 times a day, Thanks for listening, and God bless America.